From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Writer Reynolds Price came to his new book by an unusual path, hypnosis. Hypnotic treatments for pain from spinal cancer also caused Price to remember many scenes from his childhood, and those scenes fill his new memoir. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about remembering with Reynolds Price. Writer Terry McMillan is a single mother who'd like to be in a relationship, but she's tired of men who expect her to be misunderstanding, miss help boost his ego, and miss always put him first. Coming up, she discusses how the men she's shown the door inspired her new novel, Disappearing Acts. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews a new album of Debussy compositions performed by pianist Garrick Olson, and linguist Jeffrey Nunberg discusses how we use and misuse dictionaries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Bush highlighted a national drug prevention program for students today in a ceremony in the Rose Garden. He declared tomorrow National DARE Day in honor of the Drug Abuse Resistance Education Program. But he also got a surprise from one of the students taking part in the ceremony. More from NPR's Jim Angle.
DARE, the Drug Abuse Resistance Program, has spread from 50 classrooms in Los Angeles to more than 3 million children in 49 states. It offers drug education and teaches decision-making and how to resist peer pressure to use drugs. Three graduates of DARE read the essay each must write as part of the program. One of them, 13-year-old Sean T. Charles of Arlington, Virginia, attacked the death penalty, something President Bush, who was standing nearby, has strongly supported.
To me, killing someone that has committed a very serious crime is wrong. It does not solve anything. All it does is takes away someone else's life.
At the end of the three essays, the president stepped forward and thanked the three students for doing so well before a big, scary audience and for saying what's in your heart, he said, not worrying if people agree with you or not. I'm Jim Angle at the White House.
Methane gas ignited a flash fire in a coal mine today, killing 10 miners and burning 3. Authorities say there is nothing to indicate anyone was trapped underground at the Pyro Mining Company's Williams Station Mine in western Kentucky. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is expected to approve a wide-scale testing program of a new AIDS drug late this week or next. The drug is DDI. It is a cousin of the AIDS drug AZT. NPR's Richard Harris reports that thousands of people may be able to get the drug free once the new tests are approved.
Right now, only the drug AZT is proven to work against the AIDS virus, but the drug has strong side effects, so many people can't tolerate it. Early tests of a rival drug, DDI, suggest that it has fewer side effects, but scientists don't yet know whether DDI can prolong the lives of people with AIDS. Even so, the Food and Drug Administration is apparently preparing to approve wider use of DDI while testing of the drug continues. Bristol Myers, which makes DDI, has asked the FDA to allow DDI to be distributed free to people with AIDS who can't tolerate AZT. And if the FDA approves that request, 7 to 10,000 people might be eligible for DDI. AIDS activists want the drug to be distributed even more widely, but the FDA is not considering that issue just yet. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
President Bush won his first veto contest today when the Senate narrowly failed to override his veto of a bill attaching conditions to an agreement with Japan to jointly develop the new Japanese FSX fighter. The vote was one short of the two-thirds majority needed to override. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 27 points today to close at 2679.52. This is NPR News. Vice President Dan Quayle and Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner will visit Alaska next week to check on the progress made in the cleanup of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. The visit comes as Quayle heads to Asia for 12 days. It's intended to refocus attention on the nation's worst oil spill. The United States and Nicaragua had no high-level diplomatic contact for almost 5 years until an unannounced meeting last week in Managua. George Guetta reports from the State Department.
The meeting involved President Daniel Ortega and a congressional delegation in which a top State Department official, Janet Mullins, was a participant. The meeting was something of a milestone because no U.S. official had had substantive contacts with any Sandinista official since January of 1985. Mullins, who heads the State Department's Congressional Affairs Office, outlined to Ortega U.S. interest in a free and fair election process when Nicaraguans go to the polls in February. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said that Mullen's participation in the meeting does not foreshadow a resumption of a U.S.-Nicaraguan dialogue. Still, Sandinista officials saw the event as a source of encouragement. Officials of Nicaraguan Contras, meanwhile, expressed deep disappointment. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
The American Federation of Teachers said today that commonly used high school textbooks too often give students a picture of American history that is flat and dull. The 158-page critique analyzed five books and said they neglect the role of religion in American history, give short shrift to old world roots, and fail to explore deeply the thinking of such important figures as Abraham Lincoln. The report says publishers labor too hard to balance affirmation and negation, and the result is a detached neutrality, passionless about both the ugly and the beautiful moments in American history. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 27 points to close at 2679.52. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We had expected to be joined by actor Donald Sutherland, but he's unable to make it today. My guest is Reynolds Price. In 1984, when Reynolds Price was a third of the way into writing his sixth novel, Kate Vaden, he discovered he had a cancerous tumor in his spine. He went through surgery and radiation treatments, and 6 months after his initial diagnosis, he resumed work on the novel Kate Vaden. It became his best-selling and most critically acclaimed work and won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Though Reynolds Price is now confined to a wheelchair with no use of his legs, the last 5 years have been the most prolific period of his life. He's completed 4 novels, a book of poems, a collection of essays, 4 plays, and he's just written a memoir titled Clear Pictures, First Loves, First Guides. Price also teaches at Duke University. He spent most of his life in North Carolina, and most of his novels are set in the South. Reynolds Price's new memoir covers his life from infancy to age 21. In the introduction, he tells how his childhood memories opened up to him after he underwent hypnosis for pain relief.
I was having fairly severe back pain after 3 major spinal surgeries. The hypnosis was an attempt to help me relax even more than I'd been able to by any other method, such as biofeedback. Drugs had been of no use whatever. It only made me drowsy. The hypnosis really was a final attempt at deep relaxation. So it's the actual method of it simply was about a 15-minute monologue by my therapist, who was in the Department of Psychiatry at Duke University. And it was simply a sort of visual set of images bringing me down through clouds, through water, down lengthy corridors into a state of great relaxation, and then talking to my mind about the visualization of those parts of my body which were in pain, and the attempt to project those parts outside my body and to cool that heat and pain down. It's extraordinarily effective, but we never worked at all in the hypnosis on memory regression, though that's one of the main uses of hypnosis, especially in psychiatry departments.
Why did you decide to not undergo the memory exercises? Because you were thinking of doing that.
Yeah, I was a bit suspicious, or superstitious is probably better, about tampering that for no really urgent reason with things that my mind might well have, in its own wisdom, decided to keep hidden. I think one of the major difficulties about memory regression is that one is likely to one may uncover some repressed traumatic memory from childhood. And I felt none of the kind of present anxieties that would have recommended such a procedure. So I saw no reason to tamper with a mind that seemed pretty much at peace with itself at the time.
I thought the hypnotist gave you an interesting warning, which is that memories from childhood come back as you experienced it as a child.
Isn't that fascinating?
It really is, because it means it would be every bit as scary when it came back to you as an adult. You wouldn't
exactly
have your adult perspective on it.
The noises would be overwhelming, and the sights would be very large indeed.
But what you found was, after the hypnosis helped you with pain, that you were getting flooded with memories.
Sort of parallel occurrence and a parallel delight was that as I worked more at home and away from the therapist, first working with a cassette recording of his voice, and then with my own concentration, I just began to find that great rooms of memory were being opened to me. Great files were being rolled out of my unconscious. And I actually began by getting back a lot of information about a boys' summer camp in the Smoky Mountains where I'd worked as a camp counselor when I was 20 years old. And in fact sat down fairly quickly and wrote a novel based on some of my experiences that summer, the summer of 1953. It was only after I'd done that that the number of family memories and memories of my own childhood that had begun also pouring in really convinced me that perhaps it was time to start writing down some of those memories. And as I began writing them, not really planning to write a book, each memory that I got seemed to bring forward even more memories. It was like sort of pulling on what turned out to be a fairly endless string.
Now, friends had urged you after your spinal cancer to sit down and write a memoir, and you resisted that for a long time. Why?
Well, I think the main reason was simply that I knew what they were saying was, you're dying, get it down in time. And since I was working very hard on not dying, on not obeying my doctors and those people who obviously felt that my time was extremely limited, I was concentrating very much on myself and my adversary, which was spinal cancer, and I wasn't about to cooperate to the extent of sort of making my last will and testament by laying out the story of my life.
Novelist and essayist Reynolds Price is my guest, who's written a new memoir titled Clear Pictures. Well, let's talk a little bit about the experience of reliving your childhood. You make a very interesting observation, which is that even, you know, a normal childhood is filled with all kinds of terrors. And you have a paragraph about that that I'd like for you to read.
None of the fears I met at 51 when my life was broken like a stick across some broad but unseen knee, and the fractured pieces were flung back into my numb hands to use as I could. No terror matched the childhood threats I've described. My guess is a great many people will grant the same as the trials of age fly up in their road like actual demons whose harmless shadows we met and partly tamed in Halloween games. Any soul that endures a normal childhood, not to speak of the all but unthinkable innocents who last through torture at the hands of adults or disease or God, is made of strong stuff, a thing worth trusting thereafter in the dark.
What were the worst terrors of your childhood when you looked back on them?
Well, I think the worst terror of my early childhood, say from age 4 and 5 on into perhaps 8 or 9, was really the great fear that my father, who had been an alcoholic but was in recovery from the time I was about 3 years old, my greatest fear was that he would return to drinking. I had never seen him in any state of inebriation and had certainly never seen him actually take a drink. But I learned accidentally fairly early in my life that indeed he had had very serious problems. And being the very watchful child I was and being the only child in the house until I was 8, I was pretty concerned to be a kind of little temperance officer on the premises.
How would you do that?
Oh, monitoring very carefully what I saw when friends of my parents came over and brought bottles, hanging out as long as they'd let me, and then when time came to put little Reynolds to bed, feeling fairly miserable that I could no longer be in there, being quite certain that he wasn't drinking. Little did I know that he was very strong in his resolve and that apparently he felt no temptation to drink in the presence of these cheerful friends after football games. But I didn't know that. Children know very little about the possibility of change in human life. They assume that any condition is permanent and cannot be altered, it seems to me. It's one of the desperate things about childhood.
Yeah, you make that point in your memoir, and I think it's a really interesting one. You say that you even wish that one of your trustworthy aunts would have tried to explain to you that time changes things and that you're not stuck in this condition, whatever the condition is at the moment, for the rest of your life. But I have to say that I think I had parents who tried to convince me of that, and it didn't work.
I think you're right. I still feel stuck. I think I even say that perhaps it wouldn't have worked. But children simply don't have the experience of time. They don't have any sense of perspective. And understandably, they feel absolutely trapped. What they are feeling at this moment is presumably what they're going to be feeling for the rest of their lives. I had enormously happy times in my childhood, and I suppose on balance, if I look back, I would have to say that I had a serene and lovely childhood, but that's not to cover the fact that there were very bad moments indeed, and all of them I've at least tried to be honest about in this memoir.
I want to read the very first sentence of your memoir. You write, "One of the stranger days of my life came in March 1987, when I passed the age at which my father died. He lived for 54 years. What was the significance of being older than your father was when he died?
Well, Freud said, and I go on in that same passage to say that Freud said the most important day of a man's life is the day of his father's death. It certainly was the most important day of my life in the sense of letting me see in a kind of blinding suddenness that I was now the next man in line in our family, that life now was a thoroughly serious matter, that there were no backstops behind me, there were no safety nets under me, as indeed there proved not to be. I loved him tremendously, and our relations had been intimate, though marked by a peculiar kind of Victorian formality. But at the time of his death, I simply realized I was a man, and he had awarded me that knowledge by essentially insisting that I preside over the awful last days of his life.
I want to have you read another section, and this is a section where your father has a brain tumor, and he's about to be wheeled in for surgery, and you're with him during those last moments before the operation. Would you read that section?
Yes, it's actually it's lung tumors, lung cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
"Anyone who's undergone radical surgery or seen a friend through it will supply here the desert clarity of the stale air that fills a room in those last private minutes. If the patient knows that his condition is grave, that his hopes are severely limited, then both he and you are visible in your dire helplessness as never before. You hang in a narrow space with miles of distance between him and you, and you meet each other's eyes like partners in a killing or victims about to be shot at the edge of a ditch they've made you dig all night. No firing squad can thrust you out of warmth and safety onto the windy ledges of mortality quicker than the arrival of two orderlies in surgical green with a rolling stretcher. The patient is either trying to pray or is grappling in silence with doubts, real fears, and the need to show heroic calm. The friend is also trying his version of similar needs, and the line dividing the two is paper thin. One is the victim, today. The friend is wild with a thanks he must not show, a thanks that freezes if he's realistic and knows he's next. Then before you've mastered your face and voice, the orderlies start their urgent work. Your last exchanges lapse into code. Never goodbye or thanks, but empty promises of meeting. I'll be right here when the ether wears off. Don't give away any state secrets now. The patient remembers the wedding ring he's forgot to take off. He hands it to you. You wear it for safety. Then the stretcher rolls, and at last you see with scalding newness how near to lost any loved one is, racked out flat under taut white sheets. How lost you'll be when your day comes."
You've really been on both sides of that scene. You've been the son with his father when the father was about to undergo surgery, and then you've been the person having surgery yourself when you had the spinal operations for the tumor. Did you feel like you were able to handle either side of that with more grace?
Well, obviously, if I had to take my choice again, I'd still prefer to be the person who's not on the table. I think it's what I tried to suggest in the passage, and it's one of the grimmer passages in the book, obviously. I hope readers won't, or potential readers won't think that the book is made up entirely of such awful moments. I just think that at such moments, a sort of courage takes over in the vast majority of human beings. Certainly a sense of inevitability takes over. one of the major things that hospital personnel know how to do, perhaps unconsciously, is to convert one into a passive victim fairly rapidly. And there's nothing to do but simply be rolled ahead to face whatever comes. In my case, I was very lucky, and degrees of healing and long years of work were the result of those awful moments. My father's case, unfortunately, he was dead within about 5 days.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing and your life, but we're going to have to take a short break here. My guest is novelist and essayist Reynolds Price, and he's written a new memoir, which is called Clear Pictures, First Loves, First Guides. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Reynolds Price is my guest. Your father died 5 days after his surgery when you had your first spinal operation.
Yes.
Did you think you were going to survive it?
I did. I don't think I seriously considered the possibility, though that was part of the surgeon's warning, as it generally is before any serious surgery. But I did not feel that I would die on the table.
Can I ask you the kind of half-empty, half-full type question? When you survived the operations and ended up a paraplegic, but ended up with energy, alive, and with, I think, a pretty good prognosis, did you feel really angry or lucky?
No, I don't feel angry at all. In fact, doctors kept telling me I was supposed to feel angry. Get the anger out of your system, but who was I supposed to be angry at? Cancer? No one was responsible that I could possibly see, and I certainly don't feel responsible myself. It was perhaps a gift from my genes, but in any case, the results in my life have been, without wanting to sound revoltingly sentimental about it, the results have been very far from tragic. My work has increased in quantity fairly dramatically, and I like the work that I've done in recent years as much, if not more, than the work I'd done before. I've also, I think, acquired kinds of readers and respondents to my work that I hadn't reached before. Certainly my friends have responded with wonderful, sane attentiveness, and I spend probably under 30 seconds a week feeling self-pitying or longing for some earlier physical state.
Writer Reynolds Price is my guest, and he's written a memoir called Clear Pictures. You say in your memoir that your aim is to go on being a picture maker, and that's something that you've done almost all your life, either drawing or writing, because you used to draw even before you wrote. And you ask the question, why is it that people spend so much time copying their worlds? And I think it's a really important question, and a question that certainly gets to the what makes art important type of question. What are your answers to it?
It is very strange, isn't it? As far as we can see, no other mammal even attempts to copy his visible world. All organic creatures at least copy themselves in physical offspring, in children or baby whales or whatever. But we're the creature who draws pictures of other creatures, and pictures of sunsets and trees and bison. I essentially have no idea why we do it. I'm absolutely fascinated, and I feel very compelled by it. I'm also aware that if you set up your easel on the boardwalk or in a park and start drawing the face of the nearest child, you'll draw a crowd as quickly as anyone pursuing any other activity in the park. Human beings are fascinated by those people who have the ability to portray the world recognizably. The only thing I can hope to offer, and it's almost a cliche of an answer, is simply that we have at least a temporary sense of controlling reality, if indeed we can we can look at it closely enough to transfer its lines onto paper.
I just want to ask you a question about pain. Earlier you were describing the hypnosis that you use to help with pain, and that seemed really effective. Do you still have pain problems now?
I have a fair amount of pain. I must say the hypnosis and biofeedback have really, in the closeness with which they resemble Oriental techniques of meditation, they've really helped me to accept the pain as an ongoing condition of my life, which is as real as the fact that I lose X number of gray hairs a day and when I shower. It's simply there, but it doesn't frighten me or threaten me as it had done earlier, which obviously we're taught. I mean, one of the purposes of pain is to warn us that something terrible is going on. In my case, almost all my pain is phantom pain. It's pain coming from legs that in fact can no longer move. So the real problem is getting my brain to turn off those alarm circuits now that the fire is essentially out.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the pain of the old vet, you know, who lost his leg at Gettysburg, but still his right toe still itches because his brain tells him that something's wrong down there in that long absent leg.
I've read the first sentence of your memoir out loud, and I think I'd like to close by reading your last two sentences out loud. You write, "With age, I'd hoped for the gift to be simple. At the age I am now, this is what came." Tell us why you always wanted to, what you mean in the sense of writing of the gift to be simple and why you wanted that.
The gift to be simple is a famous Quaker hymn. Most people probably know it in Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. I from the earliest adult reading that I did in my life of people like Milton and Shakespeare, Tolstoy, Goethe, etc., I certainly became aware that a certain kind of genius, not American geniuses, by the way, but generally European and Oriental geniuses, have done their greatest work when they were old men or old women, and the power and clarity and lucidity and simplicity of that work had always lured me as a hope that I might get there. I think what I mean at the end of the memoir is that really I continue to hope right to the end of the book and afterward, now that it's available to the eyes of readers, I continue to hope that it's as clear and as simple as I could possibly make it and remain true to the richness and mystery of the beings and actions that I was trying to describe.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about writing in your life. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Reynolds Price's memoir is called Clear Pictures. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the next Fresh Air, comic actor Christopher Guest turns to directing. We talk about his new film, The Big Picture, a satire of Hollywood agents and studio execs. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. McMillan once wrote, "As a black woman in America, it's disheartening and even frightening to accept the fact that because I've been labeled strong and independent, I'm viewed as a threat to black men and my chances of finding Mr. Right are slim." In a way, that's half the story of McMillan's new novel, Disappearing Acts. The other half is told from the perspective of a man. Coming up, we meet Terry McMillan. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of Garrick Olson playing some Debussy etudes you may never have heard. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg tells us why looking up a word in the dictionary may not be as helpful as you'd think. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. David Dinkins, who won yesterday's Democratic primary for mayor of New York City, appeared today at a unity rally at City Hall. In November, Dinkins, who is currently serving as Manhattan Borough President, could become the city's first black mayor. Jim Zeroli reports.
Dinkins stood on the steps of City Hall alongside the three men he defeated yesterday, including Ed Koch, who lost his bid for an unprecedented fourth term. Dinkins said it was important for the party to come together to defeat former U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani, the Republican candidate, in November.
Yesterday we were rivals, today we are allies. United in battle against common foes. Those common foes are crime and drugs, poverty and pollution.
Dinkins got 51% of the vote yesterday compared to 42% for Koch. His support came from a coalition of liberal whites, blacks, and Hispanics. A progressive liberal, Dinkins pledged in his campaign to try to unite the city, which has suffered from racial conflict in recent months. For National Public Radio, this is Jim Zeroli in New York.
In Detroit, incumbent Mayor Coleman Young was first in that city's multi-candidate primary and will face second-place finisher Tom Barrow in November. In Los Angeles, the city attorney has cleared Mayor Tom Bradley of criminal wrongdoing on conflict of interest charges. But in a lengthy report, the city attorney is critical of the mayor's conduct. Today, the city attorney sued Bradley for violating state financial reporting laws. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more from Los Angeles.
The lawsuit filed today in Superior Court charges that Bradley intentionally or negligently failed to report financial interests in stocks and other investments on six occasions over the past several years. The suit seeks civil penalties that could amount to hundreds of thousands of dollars, though the amount public officials have paid in similar cases in the past has been far less. In addition to the lawsuit, the city attorney today issued a 691-page report summarizing its lengthy and comprehensive investigation into charges that the five-term mayor violated conflict of interest laws. The most serious charge, that the mayor used his influence to get $2 million in city funds deposited in a bank which had paid him as an advisor. Today, city attorney James Hahn told reporters there was no evidence or insufficient evidence to prove actual violations of conflict of interest laws. But he said, ethics are not a game. Public officials must avoid even the appearance of conflict. This, he said, the mayor clearly failed to do. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
In Medellin, Colombia, gunmen traded fire with police guarding the home of a judge who specializes in drug cases. A group linked to drug cartels has threatened to kill 10 judges for every suspected drug dealer extradited to the United States. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 28 points. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Pianist Garrick Olson has been impressing critics and audiences with his performances of unfamiliar compositions. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new album of Olson performing two works by Claude Debussy, including a series of etudes you may not have heard before.
Pianist Garrick Olson belongs to a younger generation of superior performers who are not only technically dazzling, but musically probing and adventurous. The last time I heard him, he was doing the humongous hour-long Busoni Piano Concerto with the Cleveland Orchestra and Chorus. Last year, he recorded splendid versions of the now rarely played but brilliant piano sonatas of Carl Maria von Weber. Olsen is a big, bearded bear of a man. When you watch him play, his fingers seem to span the entire keyboard. But what sensitive and nimble fingers they are. Though he often performs the big bravura showpieces, he plays with equal grace a more intimate and subtle repertoire. His latest recording is a Debussy album. One of the two pieces on it should be immediately recognizable. The Suite Bergamasque is one of Debussy's most popular works, and the third of its four sections, Clair de Lune, is probably even better known than the composer himself. Olsen makes you feel he's composing this as he plays. It's very understated, touchingly hesitant. The moonlight itself seems to hover among the trees, above the antique dance that the title Suite Bergamasque suggests. Then listen to how Olsen relaxes into the middle section. Then the transition to the last section of the suite, the passe-pied, is all the livelier with Olsen's terrific rhythmic lilt. Debussy wrote his remarkable two books of 12 etudes nearly 16 years later, in 1915, just after the outbreak of World War I. They are dedicated to the memory of Chopin, who also wrote two poetic books of etudes, or studies. But there is nothing backward-looking about Debussy's. They are his most experimental piano pieces, daring, mercurial, even wayward. And though their titles suggest exercises in fingering and texture, there's nothing academic about them. The first etude, For the Five Fingers After Monsieur Czerny, at first sounds like a child practicing. But when our child prodigy begins to hit wrong notes, the whole piece takes off in amazing directions. Said that if Debussy had given these pieces imagistic titles like The Sunken Cathedral or The Girl with the Flaxen Hair instead of For Repeated Notes and For Composite Arpeggios, they might be a lot better known. Let's hear some of number 6, For Eight Fingers, or should I call it Le Vol de la Phalène Dorée sur le Miroir de la Pluie, The Flight of the Gilded Moth in the Mirror of Rain.
Butler Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new arabesque recording of Garrick Olson performing Debussy. This is Fresh Air. In a 1987 essay, Terry McMillan wrote, "Most of my girlfriends happen to be black, smart, ambitious, idealistic, over the age of 30, and professional. The silver thread that binds us is one that sometimes causes us embarrassment. We don't have a husband or a steady man in our lives, though most of us would like to." Her new novel, Disappearing Acts, is about a romance between a woman and a man who are so different from each other, they each feel they are sacrificing parts of their identities to keep the relationship together. Disappearing Acts is written in the alternating voices of the two main characters. Zora is a young teacher with ambitions to be a singer and songwriter. Franklin is a high school dropout who used to have a drug problem. He's a construction worker, but is often laid off. I asked Terry McMillan what she most wanted to understand about Franklin through finding and writing in his voice.
I think I wanted to understand his anger, his hurt, his sense of rage, and also his sense of disappointment in himself. Because he made some bad decisions, and as a result, he's suffering from them. But I was trying to also understand how you deal with that. I wanted to get closer to his sense of helplessness. At the same time, he puts on this facade, you know, that he basically has it all together, that he is a super confident man. But underneath, he's not. He's pretty frightened.
Did you have a person to pattern his voice after?
Well, yes and no. He's sort of a culmination of a lot of voices. My brother, my ex, a lot of men that I've known over the years, and I sort of combined all of them. The ones that I think are not so much losers, but men who are pretty dissatisfied with the quality of their lives, and there's a similarity in the tone. That I hear a lot of.
Mm-hmm. I want you to compare the two voices that you've written in, the voice of the main female character, Zora, and the main male character, Franklin. And this is deeper into the book. After they've had a baby, they're not married, and their relationship is really on the skids. She's supporting both of them. He's been laid off. He's been drinking a lot. And she's just bought him some... she just helped him start to do some woodworking in the house.
Mm-hmm.
The two excerpts I'm going to ask you to read is about picking the baby up from the daycare center. And the first excerpt is in Zora's voice.
Okay. "When I walked in from work the next day, Franklin was hard at work. 'Where's Jeremiah?' I asked. 'Aw, shit. I knew it was something else I was supposed to do. Baby, I'll go get him right now.' 'He forgot?' 'Never mind,' I said, 'never mind. I'll get him tomorrow, I promise. I was just so into this, I got lost, baby. I got to change my measurements again, I'm sorry.'"
That was a chapter in Zora's voice, and part of that is a conversation with Franklin. Let me ask you to describe the same incident from Franklin's perspective.
Okay. Zora didn't even try to understand why I didn't want to pick Jeremiah up from the babysitter. She didn't have no idea how embarrassing that shit would have been for me. So I used waiting for a phone call on my woodworking as an excuse. But that wasn't it. I couldn't stand the thought that all the people in that house knew I wasn't working, knew it was Zora paying her. And I didn't want to be looked at and see the question in her eyes like, 'What do you do all day?' 'What I do all day is drink and stare at the walls and listen to music."
So when you were writing Disappearing Acts, your new novel,
mm-hmm.
did you find yourself believing more in either of the two characters? Because you had to create both of them. You had to put your heart and soul into making both of them.
Initially, when I wrote this book, I was a little angry. And I think I didn't have as much compassion for Franklin. And the second time, third time around, the more I got into him, the more I did develop a lot more empathy for him, because I sort of started to understand what it was like not to be able to bring home the bacon and have a woman who was proud of you. as a woman who has been in a situation like this myself, I know what it's like from a woman's point of view, but I was more interested in exploring the male character's point of view, especially being a black man, and the fact that this guy tried, and what happens when you keep trying and you keep trying and nothing happens, and how you get worn out. So I think I came to understand that.
So do you buy his argument that he gives, for instance, in the excerpt that you just read, that he didn't want to pick up the baby at the babysitter because it would have been too embarrassing to let everybody know that he didn't have a job and that Zora was actually supporting him?
I think I buy it, but, you know, sometimes when things get rough, people use everything as an excuse for not doing things. And I think this is just one more excuse that Franklin uses, even though for him it was probably valid. You know, I mean, that's part of what this whole thing is about. A lot of times we don't understand what it's like being in someone else's shoes. You know, all Zora was thinking about was that he did not pick the kid up from the babysitter and that here's one more thing she has to do.
The title of Disappearing Acts, in a way, refers to how sometimes part of your identity can disappear when you fall in love with someone who who make certain demands of you, you know. What kinds of things do you feel like you've sacrificed in relationships that led you to these conclusions? You know, parts of yourself that you found disappearing.
You mean personally?
Yeah.
Whoa. You know, I've always, I guess, been somewhat of a quote-unquote nurturer. And, you know, I've always been a believer and pretty too idealistic in a sense. And, you know, I think I've given up a lot of myself in order to help some men that I've dealt with in a romantic fashion to let them know that I believed in them. But the bottom line is that what I ended up finding out was that a lot of them didn't believe in themselves, and that's when I got drained, and I just said, later for this, I'm out of here. And it's happened to me a number of times. I mean, I'm 37 now. You know, all these men were, like, brilliant in their own terms, you know, had all these talents, from filmmakers to sculptors to photographers, I mean, all kinds of things. And they didn't have the faith in themselves that they displayed so vehemently in the beginning. And I always ended up getting disappointed. And I was sick of it. So I've had it. I mean, I'm not giving up on men. But the ones with the potential, I'm not into it anymore. I went through that in college.
When you say you're giving up on the men with potential, you mean giving up on thinking that somehow you'd be capable of helping them bring out that potential and getting them out of that rut of a failure and disappointment that they'd been in.
You got it. I mean, at 35 or 40 years old, if they don't already have a positive and, you know, a really good sense of who they are and what they're about, and if their values aren't intact and stuff, I don't want to be bothered. I'm sorry. I just can't handle it anymore. I have a 5-year-old son, and any man that comes into my life is going to have to be a role model. And plus, you know, I would like to be able to lean my head on someone's shoulder for a change instead of always having them lay theirs on mine. I mean, I can barely walk straight now.
You know, in your novel, as Franklin's confidence falls, he starts to get abusive and starts hitting Zora.
Well, he slaps her once.
You said the novel is very autobiographical, and I was wondering if you knew what it felt like to be hit by a man and suddenly realize maybe this person isn't the person you thought. Maybe there's a side of him that you really didn't know, a side you don't want to get to know.
Well, I got slapped once, and I mean, I was shocked. I really couldn't believe it, but I whopped him back in the mouth and made his mouth bleed. He was shocked too. And then we sort of both just looked at each other. And, you know, I mean, I grew up seeing a lot of violence, not only in my household, but a whole lot of households. And I always knew that when I grew up, you know, any man that put his hands on me, that was it. He was history. And I told this man, you know, I'm not going to be one of these kind of women that you can, if you think you can do it now, you're going to continue. And, you know, today it's a smack, next time it's your fist. If this is the only way that you can handle your anger, I don't need to be around you.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how you first got published.
Ishmael Reed published a story. He was teaching at Berkeley at the time, and he, you know, I took this one workshop from him, and he told me that I had talent that I could write. And I wrote this story that he ended up publishing in this literary quarterly that he was editing. And then it were like years later, I just continued to write because I never dreamed in a million years that I would one day be a quote unquote writer. And it was nothing that I really aspired to. I just couldn't stop doing it. And then I won this fellowship for this story that I had started called Mama Take Another Step that ended up, thanks to the Harlem Writers Guild, becoming a novel. And sent it to Houghton Mifflin because I had this baby and I was 3 months behind in my rent and nothing was happening. And I said, what the hell? And it was for this fellowship. So I mailed it and they published it, to make a long story short.
I have one last question for you, and we only have about a minute left.
Okay.
The characters in your novel always watch Wheel of Fortune and mentally play along and figure out what it is that they've won. Weren't you actually a contestant on Wheel of Fortune?
Yes, I was.
How'd you get on?
Hey, let me tell you, it was crazy. I was visiting L.A. when my son Solomon was he was just turning one. And when I was breastfeeding, I used to watch Wheel of Fortune every day. That was the time I fed him. And, I mean, I won so many cars and trips and stuff. And I said, when I was going out there, I told my sister to call. And I went through this battery of tests, which were hard. And I got on, and I won a set of encyclopedias. That's what I picked out, because as a child, we never could afford them. And I got them. So it was a fantasy.
Well, Terry McMillan, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Terry McMillan's new novel, Disappearing Acts, is published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, are you doing a wrap-up of yesterday's elections?
We certainly are, starting with New York City, where the Democratic primary sunk the prospects of Mayor Ed Koch. And we'll be looking at the fortunes of some other prominent Democrats around the country. We have a story on the march in South Africa, which was apparently a very big one. And we're going to look again at the refugees coming from east to west in Germany. This time, we'll be talking to people in East Germany about how they feel about it, and we're going to take a look at the Soviet Union and how what sort of role they're playing and how Gorbachev will be affected by what's happening.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The last time you looked up a word in the dictionary, did the definition you found make sense to you? Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says we should redefine our expectations of the dictionary.
I got a call from my friend Judith Wasso, who'd been going over a homework assignment with her ninth grade daughter, Molly. One of those deals where you have to look up a list of unfamiliar words in the dictionary and use them in a sentence. Molly was clearly having problems. For example, she looked up the word rhetorical, and part of the definition was showy, concerned with style and effect. So she put down the sentence, "The girl had a very rhetorical room." I told Judith that the fault was not with the dictionary that Molly was using. And it wasn't any reflection on Molly's mental capacities. I can personally vouch for the fact that there ain't no flies on Molly Wasso. The real villain in the story is the age-old idea that the best way to learn the meaning of a new word is to look it up in a dictionary the moment you run across it. Hence all those homework assignments involving dictionary skills, which begin in fifth or sixth grade and continue through high school. But a couple of recent studies by Princeton psychologist George Miller and Patricia Gildea suggest that this isn't really a very effective way of learning the meaning of a word. What a dictionary does, after all, is to take all the different uses of a word and pull them out of context, then supply them with a collection of paraphrases that are also taken out of context. And if you don't know the meaning of the word in the first place, this is usually not very helpful. There's an old story about a kid who writes in a composition, "My father came home from work with a cliché on his face." His teacher asks him what he means, and he says, "But I looked up cliché in the dictionary, and it said a worn-out expression." That story's probably apocryphal, but Miller and Gildea found that this kind of misunderstanding was very common. They would ask a kid to look up the word erode and use it in a sentence, and the kid would respond with something like, "Our family erodes a lot." This was puzzling, until they realized that the dictionary definition for erode included the phrase eat out, eat away. Or they'd find a kid writing, the cook stimulated the soup, since one of the synonyms given for stimulate is stir up. Overall, in fact, the dictionary plays a very overrated role in vocabulary learning. Even if kids were to look up a new word every single day, that would account for only about 5% of the vocabulary that the average high school student learns in a single year. We pick up most of our new words from reading and listening, glomming their meanings out of the context by a mysterious process that is what really intrigues psychologists about the whole business. Now, I have nothing against encouraging kids to use the dictionary to look up unfamiliar words, as long as it doesn't stop there. But if that were all that dictionaries were good for, there'd be no need for them to define all the familiar words that everybody already knows how to use. Until 200 years ago, in fact, dictionaries listed only what were called hard and unusual words. You could find a definition for fatuous, but none for foolish, stupid, or silly. You'd find tedious, but not dull or boring. But as any lexicographer will tell you, it's the simple words that are hardest to define and the most instructive to think about. That's why the Oxford English Dictionary gave a total of 23 pages to the definition of the single word set. It's a real page-turner for us word nerds, but who else would ever look it up? I guess what I'd really like is for Molly's teacher to give her an assignment that made her grapple with the problem of defining some simple words like silly and foolish, or even nerd and wimp, and then send her to a couple of dictionaries to see how they handled the job. Then she might come to see what most people never realize, that the dictionary is not just a useful reference book, but can sometimes even be a good read.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto. Phyllis Myers, Ed Doherty, and Amy Sallet produce the interviews on Fresh Air. Our researcher is Chris Cook. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Saturday Night Live alum Christopher Guest talks about his debut outing as a film director with The Big Picture. And journalist Alec Wilkinson investigates the sugarcane fields of Florida and calls the working conditions there a form of modern-day slavery. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.